You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. The idea of the entrepreneurial state, or the state as investor, has taken off in recent years following the release of an influential book by the economist Mariana Mazzucato. This view that state investment weighs very heavily in economic growth and innovation now forms the basis of contemporary public policy. Our government's industrial strategy effectively proposes that the state should play a key role in rebalancing the economy. Joining us today, the IEA's head of research, Dr. Jamie White, and James Price, campaign manager at the Taxpayers Alliance, put this totemic idea under the spotlight. They weigh up how much growth can actually be attributed to state-led investment, as is often claimed. Interviewed by editorial manager Madeleine Grant, they question a number of common assumptions about state-led investment and provision of services, and ask whether contemporary attempts to rebalance the economy differ from the old-school industrial strategy of the 1970s, or are simply repackaging the same bad ideas. If you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe to our podcast, IEA Conversations. Can we just first go through the basics of the argument?
Well, I'm not sure that there's an argument. There's a hypothesis or a thesis, which is that the state should actively engage in the kinds of activities that people like us normally think that only private enterprises should engage in, so that they should, you know, start businesses and try to innovate and do all the kinds of things that you would expect an entrepreneur to do. And that's why the book is called The Entrepreneurial State. Why it should do that is another matter, which perhaps we can come to. But that is the basic thesis.
So often what Mariana Mazzucato will do in her talks, her idea is that Silicon Valley in particular enjoyed a great deal of government funding that was integral to the creation of products that we nowadays take completely for granted. And in her talks, she will often bring out an iPhone and explain to you how the various components of that iPhone couldn't have been achieved without this large amount of government funding involved. You know, does she not have a point here?
Yeah, it's always the iPhone that she seems to use, isn't it? Because maybe it's just the first thing that she has that comes to hand. But this idea that because the iPhone has some kind of funding from some part of the American government, that's the reason why it's sat in most of our pockets at the moment. No, the reason is that Apple can make a huge markup from this. They became, the world's first trillion-dollar company a couple of months ago. And it's that kind of drive of profit that makes them get better and better every time, that slims them down, that increases the capacity of them. And that's not something that you're going to get in the government. If a government miraculously created an iPhone, they'd say, great, we've done that, it's in your pocket, it makes calls and it looks a bit pretty, fine. There's not any need to innovate or drive or go on any further. And of course, there's not another government waiting at the same time to offer the same, a slightly different phone like a Samsung that you actually get that improves the phones through proper competition.
I guess there is also an argument that it's one thing to provide the funding for components of an iPhone, but you know, that's quite a far cry from the innovation that needs to take place to bring all those components together.
So she's right about the history. The government, the US government, has been involved in the development of some of the technology that is now to be found in iPhones and vehicles of various kinds and so on. And why is that? Well, there is another government, in a sense. If you look at the history, the period that she looks at in particular is the Cold War period. And the US government was commissioning stuff for military purposes. And they were, in that sense, competing with another government, in particular the Soviet Union. And so a lot of technological advances happened in that way. So that's true, but that's not really the interesting question. The interesting question is, if they hadn't happened in that way, would they not have happened at all? And if they had happened in another way, perhaps they would have been more efficient and or done better. So there's a hypothetical here or a counterfactual. And the simple facts of history don't answer that question for you. Unfortunately, as far as I can tell, Mazzucato doesn't make many efforts to engage with the counterfactual issue. She just tells the story, and as if that in itself answers the counterfactual question.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. There's obviously serious opportunity costs that we have to consider in all of this. Another thing which a real shortcoming, I think, is the idea of survivorship bias. So for every Apple, every GPS, every whatever touchscreen that we do hear about, we simply do not hear about the government investments where money was ploughed into something. bad investments.
Yeah, it's hard to think of examples of these things that have never actually come around. But maybe you could look at example, something that's quite controversial at the moment, of e-cigarettes and vaping and things like that. An entirely consumer-led revolution that is put at complete risk by the government coming in. I think it's the Welsh Assembly who want to ban these things entirely because they don't like smoking. They think it's the same thing. And so that kind of innovation again comes in just because the dead hand of the state is scared of something, doesn't understand what it is, and is just going to come out and ban it totally. So again, there is that complete opportunity cost. And you may disagree and think that taxes are the most efficient way and some bureaucrat with their paper to push around is the most efficient way to allocate those things. If you don't, the amount of tax that comes in and the amount of distortion of the economy, who knows how many spaceships we could have created by now that are profitable at getting us to Mars or back.
One of her arguments, you know, you ask, well, why is the government better at this kind of thing than the private sector? And one argument is that private sector actors are overly risk averse. So they don't, let's say, have the time horizon of a government. They don't have the deep pockets of a government. And when I say deep pockets, I mean they can't tax people to fund it. And so there's a structural advantage for certain kinds of research or innovation to be done by governments. Now, it may be true that they do things that private sector entities wouldn't do, but it may be that they shouldn't do them. I mean, so there's always this, another problem with the analysis is it's possible we have too much money going into innovation and research. Nobody in the private sector believes their research budgets, R&D budgets, should be limitless. And it's a rational question, how much money should be thrown at research and development. And again, the problem with the government way of doing it is because the people making the decision don't bear any cost, there's every likelihood that they'll overspend and they'll spend in wasteful ways. Though this may sound perverse, it may be that we would be better off if we hadn't had some of the innovations that have come through from the state sector. And again, the problem is it's almost impossible to know because the only history we have is the history that actually happened and the technology we've actually got. It may be that if we hadn't got that technology, we would have other technology provided by the private sector who hadn't been taxed as heavily. So these things are very, very hard to pin down. And unfortunately, Mazzucato doesn't provide a methodology for doing it. She just tells a story.
Do you think you could see that in the sort of leapfrogging effect you are getting now in Africa, where they're moving straight to mobile payments with M-Pesa and things like that, without having to go through the many kind of tortuous steps that we've had to, whether it's mobile telecommunications or banking in the West? Africa is therefore benefiting from all this perhaps misallocated investment and just leapfrogging straight. Maybe that's the closest example we can find.
That's a nice example, because if you think about what a government would have been doing, if a government had come in and said, we've got to extend banking services to poor Africans, they would have said, well, that requires branches and so on. And they would have almost certainly have looked at the models from the West and tried to impose them there. Whereas a commercial person thinks, how can I do this at the lowest possible cost? We'll reach the most customers. And because they're profit-driven, yeah, I think that's a great example.
It's more that Peter Thiel zero to one rather than that horrible, frightful public sector word of best practice. Let's spread best practice and see how well it's been done somewhere else in the past.
Yeah, and I mean, good inventions, however amazing and extraordinary they are, taken as, you know, scientific advancements on their own, unless they're cheap and widely available, then they don't really change the lives of ordinary people very much. But, I mean, surely you would acknowledge examples of public goods where the state does do things best, you know, that we simply cannot rely on the markets to provide if left to themselves.
I believe that there are public goods. A public good is one that's non-rivalrous and non-excludable.
Non-excludable.
So if you... Non-rivalrous means it doesn't matter how much of it you consume, I get just as much. So, you know, the sun, the light. Non-excludable means I've got no way of stopping you from consuming it. Whereas, you say, for example, some things are excludable. Education, and I can stop you coming into the classroom. So it's non-rivalrous
and
non-excludable.
It's kind of free rider thing.
There's no way of stopping free riding is the point about public goods. And the theory is that they won't be supplied. But it's not true. So it turns out that if they're inframarginal, you know this idea, inframarginal externalities? If I have bad breath, right, that's an external cost for you. So on the standard theory, you'd say, well, we need a government subsidy for toothpaste because there will be insufficient toothbrushing if we don't, because it's an external benefit, and I don't get all the benefit of having clean teeth, you get some of the benefit. Therefore, clean mouths will be undersupplied in a free market. We need a subsidy. The reason that's not true is that I get enough benefit from having clean mouth to motivate me to buy toothpaste, right? That's inframarginal. It makes sense within the margin to me to do it. This is why you end up getting privately supplied lighthouses and things like that, even though in theory, you never should, because there can be enough of a benefit to the private supplier to warrant doing it, even though other people get to free ride. So the argument that goes directly from there's an external benefit here, therefore it must be subsidized, that inference is not always valid. It's sometimes valid, right? Because there isn't sufficient private incentive. Let's say you've got a street. Not everybody in the street wants to pay for the street lighting. They want a free ride on the other people who pay for the street lighting. So there's underfunding of street lighting. Well, fine. Maybe the government needs to come in and force people to buy street lighting. That's one issue. But there's another issue of who should actually design and build the street lighting. And I would prefer it to be done by profit-seeking private companies, because they're far more likely than a government body to come up with a new and efficient way of providing street lighting at the minimum cost, just because they'll make a bigger profit margin if they can come in at a lower cost. And then over time, the prices that people pay will fall towards that cost. So even where the government needs to be involved in ensuring that a public good is supplied, they don't need to be the ones who build the stuff and, you know, actually do it.
It doesn't even need to be these kind of essentials like street lighting or if it's police or something like that. If you, something like Hayek's idea in the road to serfdom, that even if you did have the state having 100% control of everything, if you wanted to have luxuries, for example, not everybody could have the same luxury straight away. You'd have to have some mechanism whereby we could work out what a nice luxury was. And so you'd have to either give it to probably what would end up being the members of the Central Politburo or whatever, or a lottery system that everybody would then, some people would get fur coats and then other people might go, oh, I also want a nice fur coat, and then there'd be a minister for fur coats having to spread those things around.
And so if you want,
and it would all fall apart because these things don't work. But Hayek says in the Road to Serfdom that would, you'd have to have that system if you wanted any kind of luxuries, let alone the law courts or an army.
Yeah, Hayek's generally really good on the role of what you might call wealthy consumers in advancing progress. So they are the first people who try out new stuff. So all sorts of products that have now become commonplace were once huge luxuries. The idea that a government might have started supplying those is ridiculous. They were always supplied by profit seekers who are not ashamed to supply high-end products to a very small elite group of people. Can you really imagine, let's say, the Labour government of Britain coming up with designing products for the super rich? It'll never happen, right? So you get stuck. And you saw that in the Soviet Union. Shoddy stuff. Nothing, anybody wanted anything good, they had to import it from overseas. All the rich people in the Politburo had foreign goods.
And again, those self-same evil rich people who are getting these nice things first, they're paying above the odds for the fact that that first iPhone had lots of problems with it. They'd report back because they'd be angry because they had more purchasing power. And then those improvements get taken on board. There are more of them. Apple makes a profit, makes it easier. And then it ends up filtering down to the point that I might have an iPhone 10, but my niece now, who's 11, has an iPhone 6 or something. And these things get proliferated around and spread and the costs come right down. So just the idea then you'd have to have, again, some kind of lottery system to make it fair otherwise.
Yeah, I think we often run into this idea that, well, we need the state to do something because the state has a heart and it does things for the public good.
And the profit motive is evil.
The profit motive itself is, you know, maybe it can lead to some good things, but ultimately it's driven by individualism, which is always selfish. But actually, public choice theory has a great deal to tell us about the kind of terrible incentives that can result from the political process.
Well, what kind of research is done will inevitably be a result of who manages to get the ear of the people who allocate the money from the government, and who will get their ear? Well, those with the most power, those with the most influence already, those closest to government. And so it's not at all a egalitarian kind of an approach to investing money. It goes to the connected, the well-connected, whereas in the commercial world, people are trying to make a profit. They don't care if you're their mate or not, because they want a return on their investment. And if they find someone living in, you know, a poor area, but he's got a great idea, they'll back it because they can get in on it. So it's much, the private sector is much more egalitarian. I just want to come back briefly to this thing about what kind of stuff governments will get into. And I think your e-cigarette example is really perfect. Think about the way governments have tried to deal with smoking, which they want to stop. Well, they just try to, you know, drive up the cost of cigarettes. They have campaigns to advertising against it. They would never have thought, why don't we invent a cigarette that is less harmful? That would never have crossed their minds, right? Because they're imposing a moral agenda that doesn't fit into. Whereas a profit seeker sees an opportunity here, comes up with a new product, and in fact reduces greatly the harm of smoking. So that, again, the private sector ends up benefiting the population much more than government agents with a kind of moral agenda.
And it uses those horrible things of real human emotions where humans actually act. So the Taxpayers Alliance did some research of just how much money it costs to get people to quit smoking and local councils. Hundreds and hundreds of pounds per person who ends up actually managing to quit versus, I don't know anyone here with an e-cigarette that costs a, they've got one in there, maybe cost a fiver from a petrol station forecourt for the person's first one. Boom, problem solved. As you say again, whenever the state tries to get in these things, because the incentives are misaligned and maybe just a kind of lack of imagination from the people who end up in the public sector, you don't get the results you want.
It's amazing how imaginative you become when there are millions of pounds to be made from coming up with a good idea.
Or alternatively, the wolf at your door. But this idea you were talking before, that people think that the state must have a heart, right? That's the only thing that happens. So Jamie and I have recently, we gave some evidence and some testimony to the Greater London Assembly about these local enterprise partnerships, this taxpayers-funded money that goes down to either businesses or charities and all kinds of wacky endeavours. And these are replicated across the country to help spur, whether it's the excuse is economic injustice or the downtrodden, the benighted. And we sat there and largely challenged the premise of even needing to do this. And the incredulity from some of the Assembly members said, but surely then that means you end up with a winner-takes-all society. And what about the poorest people who might want to have X, Y or Z and they can't because it's only the evil bankers who have it, completely not understanding that if people were left to their own devices, they might actually invest this money. Or if you got out of the way of lending companies and banks, that people would have a chance to do these things.
Actually, there's some interesting research from the United States on the effect of government funding for enterprises, crowding out private investment. And the way this research was done, it's a really fantastic piece of analysis. It turns out that when an American congressman gets onto a so-called spending committee, you've heard of these, like there are federal government committees that have spending power and they can allocate money to this and that cause. Well, when a congressman gets onto one of these committees, on average, the federal spending in their congressional district increases by 50%. So you can look at congressional districts where this happens and those where it doesn't, and you can look at what happens to total investment in those areas. So that's a good way of trying to work out, does government investment crowd out private investment? And the results from this research, which were done, I think, around the mid-noughties, was that it's perfect crowding out. So it makes no difference at all to aggregate investment in those areas. It just is government investment replacing what otherwise would have been private investment. If that's true, then all we're doing, we've got the same total amount of investment, we've just got a worse kind of investment because we've got investment where the people making it don't really care if it ends up being profitable or not. The crowding out phenomenon is another thing that people like Mazzucato don't really look at.
Any local journalist, of course, would know that was completely true from the BBC, with the BBC crowding out any local newspaper or anything like that at all. The BBC goes, oh, well, people in Gloucestershire, they need to know what's going on, so we'll put a section of the website in and a radio station, and then the local newspaper goes from daily to weekly and then has to shut down. But it's okay because the BBC is there and the state's doing it. What's the incentive for anyone else to try and get involved?
Yeah, or else after the referendum, people say, oh, God, isn't it terrible? There's all this funding that we get from the EU that now won't go to X place. I mean, not least the fact that we were sort of giving rather more to the EU than we were getting back in. So it was basically our own money being filtered back to us. But I guess it's the same principle, that there's no conception that that money might be generated any other way than the dead hand of the state.
And I wonder if it's just the public sector workers and bureaucrats and maybe even some journalists connected to it are only really aware of these lovely slush funds that are kicking around that normal people working in the private sector either don't have access to or don't even know exists. So how else can we possibly fund any of these nice things we want to happen unless it's from some central government pot?
We've touched on it already, but I'd like to briefly discuss the return of a centrally planned industrial strategy, which has clearly been influenced by the entrepreneurial state hypothesis. Why do you think that it's taken off so effectively? In some ways, it does seem to be repackaging quite 1970s ideas, but at the same time, it uses buzzwords like, digital revolution, digitization, innovation, fourth industrial revolution, and so on. Does this differ in any material way, or is it just, repackaging the same ideas?
Well, there's an element of that, yes. So they talk about, they'll say, we're not picking winners. They're just giving it to sectors. I said, well, you can't give money to a sector, right? It's got to be given to a company in a sector.
Why not that sector as well? Why that sector?
Yeah. So, but anyway, they are still picking winners. Of course they must be. But I think there may be one other element which is worth looking at, which is that certain kinds of rigidities in the economy that have been created by regulation are causing a shortage of capital in some areas or some problems that then this is the remedy to. So it's a very common dynamic in government. First you create a problem, then you try to alleviate that problem with another intervention, and that creates another problem and another problem. So let me be more specific. The post-financial crisis regulations around banking very much constrain, they increase the costs for banks when they lend money, especially when they lend money to small businesses. So small businesses have been complaining about a difficulty in raising capital for their projects. This is an artifact of government regulation. There may be some clamoring for the government to provide funds that the people are finding difficult to get from the private sector. That's one possible reason there's more demand for this kind of thing. The other one is that because of planning restrictions and rigidities in the housing market, a lot of people are effectively priced out of moving to the economically productive parts of Britain. So they really should be moving from poor areas into thriving areas like London and Cambridge and so on. But house prices make that impossible. So you get a whole lot of people stuck in unproductive areas, and that again creates demand for the government to pump capital into those areas so as to keep them going. So I think that some of this resurgence of the idea that the government should have an industrial policy and a regional development policy and so on are being created by things that the government itself has already done.
People are, of course, you know, well-meaning. Hayek, again, is very generous to the big statists who think, well, I care and I'm reasonably clever. Surely I've seen something bad that's happened. I can make this better. I can think of a clever way of doing this. There'll be some bit of legislation. I can get it right next time. And it builds up and it builds up in the complexity without these people ever realising that it's that stuff that's the problem in the first place and that some bright spark will come up with a better way of doing things in some way if you strip it all out of the way. It is just that idea again that, well, something must be done. Hasn't anyone told the council or whatever it may be?
You and Hayek are a little nicer than me. It's not entirely well-intentioned. Let me give you some examples from New Zealand. The national government that recently lost power had 9 years in government. Contrary to its normally expressed principles, massively increased government funding for private businesses. Crony capitalism, as my party always called it. But it's really interesting, if you look at the kinds of things that the money goes to, it's not just being guided by a desire to help in general. For example, the movie industry always seems to get a lot of money. Why is that? Right? I think government ministers quite like going and hanging out with actresses and the like and shaking hands at glamorous parties. And the money always, and you get money being directed to, there was one, it was like a windsurfing competition and things like that. And they go, oh, they'll be great. The knock-on effects will be fantastic for the local economy. But also it's quite nice to go down to the beach and meet the windsurfers and all that kind of stuff and shake their hands. And so you'll notice it's always kind of fun and glamorous things that the money goes to, and not grimy, old, boring stuff where nobody would want to turn up. I do think it's not quite as selfless in intention as you may wish.
Well, you're exactly right. And it was, I think, George Osborne and Ed Vasey who've got themselves in the credits of one of the new Star Wars films for having some kind of tax relief. I mean, again, if I were the Chancellor and I had the chance to be in the credits of a Star Wars film, maybe I'd take it.
Yeah, I mean, politicians respond to incentives just like everybody else.
Shock, the idea that politicians are humans.
Yes.
Arts funding, right? Why are the arts funded by the state? Why not greengrocer
because
funding?
Because it's important that we look after our souls. But again, that's another example of precisely what we're talking about, something that cannot be trusted to fund itself, but is considered a kind of unique public good and therefore must be in receipt of, you know, untold millions and billions.
At the Big Tent Ideas Festival at the weekend, there was some talk about opera and funding of opera. And people say, oh, I love the opera. It's wonderful, but it's very difficult to help people get involved and realise. So we just need to keep giving all this lovely subsidy and then hope that people will come and see it, rather than perhaps suggesting that if opera wanted to survive, that it would make itself, you know, the companies putting it on would make it more accessible or in some way incentivise people in, maybe by not getting so much slush fund all the time and having to make a profit to actually entice people in to come and watch it.
There is a considerable amount of money that's donated privately to these things. There are plenty of people that value this. It's just that if you can see for yourself that it doesn't require any more money. So, for example, my mum's quite religious. She goes to church every Sunday. They needed some new roof tiling. They put out an appeal for roof tiling and they made the money very quickly because it mattered to the people. I really liked your point about state investment often dampening private investment. For example, when you take a trip to the Royal Opera House, you don't necessarily think that, you know, this is the most needy cause going. You know, I think you're right. It's very important to consider that government allocation of resources will clearly impact the way in which we choose to allocate our own resources. I was reading about the New Deal recently, and I had no idea. I mean, obviously, I knew a little about the dodgy economics behind the New Deal, but not so much the absolute cronyism that was taking place. So much of the alphabet agency and federal funding was being pumped into Democrat voting constituencies and states. So you have this huge alignment between how funding was allocated and political affiliations.
Well, of course. So think about how do politicians benefit? Not from the profits of the enterprise, but from the votes that the enterprise generates. They are not profit seekers, they are vote seekers. So, of course, they are going to allocate capital to maximise the votes it delivers to them. If you say, oh, no, they really were far too good, they wouldn't do that. Well, maybe one of them is. He'll soon lose to one who isn't, yeah. Right? And so after a short period of time, if you have a system of government-allocated capital, the people who are thriving in politics will be the ones who use it to buy votes. So it doesn't matter if some of them start off good, they'll soon all end up bad.
Especially when it's not their own money that it's going for, right? The idea that an endeavour will work better when someone's got either money to win or money to lose versus if it's just government money. Forget that it's taxpayers' money, of course. So it's just government money. It's not, as it's public. We'll just give it away, more free stuff, more free borrowing, and I'll keep my seat. Perfect. A rational decision for a politician to do that, not necessarily one that we would agree with that would be good for the whole country.
I mean, the way we make progress in private markets and in free markets is really not necessarily that everybody in the free market has brilliant ideas and they come up with good things. Really, the mode of progress is that they try something and it succeeds or it fails. If it fails, the company goes broke and they're finished. Failure is eliminated and success is promoted. It's a kind of evolutionary process. Not so when it's government money, because they get bailed out the whole time. State-owned airlines are a great example of this. They never die. They just get bailed out year after year after year. The Belgian one, what was called Sabena, it had something like a 75-year history. Do you know how many years it made profits in that 75-year history? 2. It made profit only in 2 years of its history.
Potential there, then.
So just the waste behind it, it's astonishing. And so all of that money that isn't being wasted might have been used for other purposes that would have been more innovative than the things that Mazzucato, for example, points to. We'll never know, unfortunately.
Thank you both for joining me today. For more podcasts, blogs, films and reports, go to our website, iea.org.uk.